tonight on Arena. Big Banana Feet, the long-lost film of Billy Connolly's 1975 trip to Ireland, and new albums from Villagers and Kings of Leon up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. Big Banana Feet is the title of a long-lost film of Billy Connolly's 1975 Irish tour. Originally released the following year, 1976, the film was considered lost until rediscovered 4 years ago at the University of California. It has been newly restored by the BFI and was released at the Glasgow Film Festival earlier this year, inspired by the fly-on-the-wall style of D.A. Pennebaker's 1967 Bob Dylan documentary Don't Look Back. Director Murray Grigger and cinematographer Dave Peat capture Connolly at his best, performing his first ever gigs in Dublin and Belfast, and this at the height of the Troubles. Joined in studio this evening by Paul Whittington, who has been watching the film and is going to tell us a bit more about it. 1975 was quite a period. Whatever about the trip to Dublin, the trip to Belfast, very interesting that he decided to do that at that time, Paul.
Yeah, well, I mean, to cast one's mind back, I mean, sports teams weren't coming to Dublin at that point in the 1970s, never mind Belfast, because there was a general confusion in the UK, of course, about what was happening and where it was happening. And Billy Connolly had been, who at that point he'd just done a big successful UK tour, and he had appeared on Parkinson, which he said changed his life, and he told a joke about a bicycle and a dead wife, which I won't repeat here. And it was a moment. So he was at a very interesting point in his career. He'd been advised not to come, and especially not to go to Belfast. So he thought, why not?
But he kind of says at one point in the film, he doesn't quite use the words moral imperative, but he felt he had a responsibility to go to Belfast.
Yeah, I think in a way he did. I think he was partly curious. There's a very funny on the plane up, he hums the music from Dam Busters and everything, and he's like, he's making a joke, and he impersonates Ian Paisley. But I think he was both curious, but also he felt that people weren't coming, and people were buying his records over here and in Belfast, and he thought, well, I should come.
Yeah, they're buying my stuff, so they deserve to get the live show as well. You're saying that the Parkinson thing had happened, I think, just previous to the visit to Ireland, and this is his first ever visit to Ireland. How established was his career? Was he kind of on the up and up? Had he established himself, even as a comedian yet?
No, he hadn't. And in fact, in the film, he still refers to himself as a banjo player and a musician. And he'd started.
And he's not a bad banjo player.
No, he's a good banjo player and he's a good musician. And he had a couple of hits with sort of joke folk songs. But really, he had wanted to be a folk singer, a folk musician. He was born in Glasgow, as everybody knows, and he had worked as a welder, and he got onto the folk circuit and worked with people like Jerry Rafferty and Christy Moore would have met him. But he noticed in the early 1970s that people were connecting with his little patter between songs, and gradually he realised. Yeah. But he's still hiding behind the guitar.
Yeah.
And I think the Banana Feet mentioned that he had this pair of sort of banana boots. I think in a way they were to hide behind as well, like, I'm a comedian, really. So he's still finding his feet, which is very interesting.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to one of his songs, which would give you a sense of what he would do. All of them very well-known melodies, but just the words parodied and slightly changed.
Take the rollers from your hair, shake them loose and let them fall, put them down by your glass eye, in that chanty by the wall. Though your teeth are black and gone, and your breath smells out of sight, I'll put a clothes peg on my nose to help me make it through the night. Now I'm no saying that you're weird. What a voice. I'm merely trying to understand why you carved your name out with a scout knife on the back of my left hand.
Yes.
as he says himself, what a voice.
Yes, what a voice.
I mean, he is in the midst of it all. He had time to, you know, take the mickey out of himself in that respect.
Oh, absolutely.
I should explain, that's Billy Connolly from this Big Banana Feet, long lost film, extraordinary, long that has now been found again.
Lost for years. The BFI man who bought it on the internet for 50 euros reckoned it had been to the Falkland Islands at one point, this particular print. And
He bought it for 50 euros
and painstakingly restored it. And it's really interesting, not just because of where Billy was at that point. And I don't know if you've ever seen him live. I have seen him live. Mm. But this is him developing what would come later on. Yeah, there's a bit in, I think it's the Dublin gig, where he talks about this man at a bus stop in Glasgow, drunk, trying to eat chips. And that's kind of where it's going to go. And he refers to Drumchapel, where he spent his teens, because he was born in a tenement which was knocked down. And then he went to Drumchapel. He calls that a reservation on the edge of Glasgow. But he's beginning to realise that stuff, the stuff about his childhood, the Glasgow stuff, is the gold, really.
You were saying there, and we were talking about when we were listening to that song as well. Very interesting part of this is when he was in Dublin, he just couldn't get over the number of people who wanted to speak to him forever and a day before he went on stage. Yeah. All the press interviews were before the gig, and he was kind of going, well, would you not wait until you've seen the gig and talk to me afterwards?
Yeah, he says at one point these dues are exhausting, and he can see he's exhausted. Everybody's smoking, which is fascinating, including him, and drinking and everything. And, you know, he meets Áine O'Connor, the late Áine O'Connor, who sort of warns him about...
You're going to Belfast tomorrow.
Yeah, and he talks to Rodney Rice, manages to inveigle him into doing an interview, radio interview in here, I assume. Or no, maybe not in here yet, which he ends up doing hungover, which he talks about. And Niall Stokes, all the sort of media. And you can see that he does two Dublin gigs, stays in the Gresham, which was very posh place to stay at that. I'm not saying it isn't now, but it certainly was then. He stays in this huge suite. That'll do me, he says. And then he's off to Belfast, and people are kind of warning him not to go. Even in Dublin are kind of warning him not to go to Belfast. But he's fascinated.
And that fly on the wall style, as I say, goes back to the Dylan documentary of 1967, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Very much so. And the cameraman is following him around so much that he kind of forgets he's there. He's talking to his road manager. And actually, I noticed with him, he's having great fun with the tea ladies in Belfast, and also people behind stage in Dublin. And he's kind of more comfortable talking to them than he is talking to the media types. And you can see that, because that's kind of where he comes from. I think Niall Stokes asked him at one point, would you say your humour is based on Glasgow working class humour? And he says, well, I'm a working class Glaswegian, it probably is. So he's more comfortable with working class people at
that
point.
It's a funny thing that I found him saying a couple of times in the early part of the film, despite the main Irish extraction, there's Irish blood in him, he keeps saying about, you know, playing in Ireland and all of this type of thing. There's a constant question that comes up, and he says, well, I don't know, it feels very foreign to
me. He says that on a number of occasions. I was thinking about that. He meets about four people whose surname is Connolly, which he finds amusing, but he comes from a city that had, maybe Belfast would have been more familiar to him, because it was a heavy industry city, and that wasn't the case here. And he finds it very different. Later in the 80s or 90s, I think he did a Channel 4 thing, and he came, or it might have been Who Do You Think You Are, and he actually found a cottage, pre-famine cottage, where he thought his father's family came from. But at that point, no, he's finding it all very strange.
Were the Dublin gigs and Belfast gigs very different? Because was the sense of him in both cities, did you get a feeling of a different guy, a different man?
Yes, I think in the Dublin gigs, he says something. I think it was in Dublin, actually, that some wit in the audience chanted IRA, and he's very good with hecklers. He says to him, that's very brave, I'd like to see you chant that at Ibrox, basically.
Yeah, the Rangers football team park.
but I think he knew that when he went to Belfast that he was very cleverly addressed the elephant in the room. He goes on stage and he says, it's lovely to be in Belfast, and starts laughing. And they loved that, because he was addressing. Yeah. But he says he had all this sort of orange-green stuff, he said afterwards, that he was going to do. And then he thought, these people are on a night out. They don't want to hear all about that. Yeah. So he was very clever.
He was very clever in how he handled this little section that we're going to play, which is all about contraceptives. Now, remember that he had been in Dublin the previous night.
He didn't do these jokes in Dublin.
I don't know, would he have done them elsewhere? Because they seem to be so specific to joking about Dublin when up in Belfast.
In the south, they don't, of Ireland there, they don't play this record on the radio because I say bum. So last night in Dublin, I said arse. Imagine if a knee contraceptives, my God, imagine getting caught smuggling them. What's in your case, you say, oh no. Oh, it's for the Wayne's Christmas party. Oh, I mean, I'm not just being dirty for its own sake, but when I was a wee boy, we used to buy contraceptives. It was part of my upbringing. I never used them. I was only about 12. The soft hat and a pipe. And at the chemist, I was just passing in my car and I realised it. Then you keep them in your blazer pocket at school and you keep pulling them out and saying, my God, I've only got two left and it's only
Billy Connolly there, one of the scenes from the Belfast gig, which is part of the film we're speaking about this evening, Big Banana Feet, long lost film which has been now restored and rejuvenated. I think some extra material has been added back in from the original cut, which was lost in 1970 or certainly after 1970.
Yeah, and I'm not completely sure which, but possibly that, but also possibly somebody threw a flower at him at the Belfast gig and he pretended it was a bomb. He ducked, which is very funny. But it's interesting sociologically, this film as well, because when he arrives in Belfast, he meets soldiers and they're all from the Scots Regiment, and he's going like, how the hell did you end up here? And he doesn't hide the fact that he's quite bemused, but he doesn't know, like, even though he's raised in a city where even your football affiliations were decided on sectarian lines, he doesn't understand it and he doesn't pretend to.
Who is this for? Because in some ways you get to know more about Billy Connolly, but it is a wonderful sociological document of that period of time on this island.
Yeah, I mean, I think for people watching it in London, it'd be interesting, and it's all about Billy. But for people here, it really gives an insight into the kind of chasm between North and South that existed then that maybe doesn't quite so much now.
That's and definitely one to see again at all.
Yeah.
That's Paul Whiting discussing the newly restored Billy Connolly documentary, Big Banana Feet. It will be at the Lighthouse and selected cinemas around the country from today. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Musician and academic Andrea Palandri began visiting Ireland from his native Italy in his teens. He became fascinated with traditional Irish music and indeed the Irish language. He also developed a particular interest in the fiddle playing of Paddy Crone and Dennis Murphy and in the bowing techniques of Pádraig O'Queefe. Now, as part of the Irish Traditional Music Archive series Drawing from the Well, T.G. Cahir has a new series called Tuisca on Tubber. Five new artists uncover the stories of significant musicians, singers, collectors and regions. And in the very first episode of the series, Andrea Palandri traces the life and music of Sliabh Lucra fiddle master and teacher Pádraig O'Queefe. He meets musicians and researchers who have followed Pádraig's life and uncovers previously unheard recordings. So, an áthasúrm go bhfuil Andrea, hála mbainne an all, ag an am seo. Gee, which, Andrea, August, Aberlum Erdus, cover to the sim, Tavon Wheaton Kyol, Sachanga.
Dias Murukate, Jain, Grumahagut. Well, Stoch on Kyol, who the sim Satanga, but Husni Satacht, Femir Dudish, Hun Kyol, Raulim, Ach, Voiles Le Kyol Todi, Gurav Gailinuko, Agus Gobong, Tortiad Agus and Son, Hastig Wom, Stoch on Scale on Malone.
I also have to say, listening to you speak there, when we were speaking before coming to air tonight, I thought I was talking to a sound operator in Ballinangal, one of the native speakers of the region. I mean, your facility with the language is quite extraordinary. Do you think having a facility with music makes that easier?
Possibly, yeah. Lots of people ask that question, actually, and I've noticed it in other people as well. I mean, even Kyle next to me is originally from Donegal, I think, but he's learnt the West Kerry Irish and is a great musician. So, I mean, the two things do, I think, sometimes go together. Yeah, I've heard that said before.
Yeah, and because I thought that perhaps the Kyle there who's with you, I thought that your Irish might be closer to his, because your father's Italian and your mother is Scottish, and I thought, maybe he'll have a little bit of the Scots Gaelic in him, and we'll have a sense of Gaelic Ulu in you, but no, it's quite definitely Munster. Ulster Irish that you have there.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, when I started learning, I made a decision to kind of stick to the one dialect, and then sort of ignored other dialects for the beginning, and then I sort of went down that route, and yeah. You know, I have a great interest in all the dialects, but I went with West Kerry, let's say.
And I see you went with the West Kerry dialect in uh-huh. English as well. You definitely
have. I don't know about that.
Well, there's a touch of that region off you. Listen, we're going to talk about music, but before we talk about it, why don't we hear a set of reels? And these are all associated with Pádraig O'Keefe. Maybe explain who O'Keefe was, first of all, and how important he was in your mind in fiddle music in that part of the world.
Yeah, okay, so Pádraig O'Keefe was born in the late 1880s, and he learnt music from his area, probably from his uncle, Cal Callaghan, and then he taught it, let's say, from the 1920s on, perhaps small bit before, to a huge, almost an entire generation of musicians from that area. And he was very specific with his instructions in how to bow the music, and that was passed on in such a way that sort of a unique style developed, probably in a great way from those bone instructions and the ornamentation instructions that O'Keefe was given in his manuscript, which is how he taught music. So he would teach by writing a tune out
Those manuscripts are very important. We'll talk a little bit more about them, but let's have a listen to a set of reels that you have for us.
So
Quinns, what have you got for us in this one?
It's Quinns, which is it comes from a recording of O'Keefe. That's and the second one is known as The Piper's Despair, which I got from another recording of O'Keefe, and also one of his pupil, Dennis Murphy. And the third one then from a recording of Paddy Cronin, who was one of O'Keefe's star pupils and one of my favourite fiddle players. So I'll give these a blast. Thank you.
Three reels there, Quinn's A Piper's Despair and Cronin's played for us in Ballinagall this evening by Andrea Palandri, who is the presenter of episode one of a new series on T.G. Carr, Tríosca an Tobair, Drawing from the Well, and Andrea looking at the fiddle music of Páraic O'Keefe in that first episode. If you have the lilt of Munster in your speaking of Irish, you certainly have the lilt of Munster in the playing on in your playing on the fiddle there, Andrea.
Thank you very much.
We mentioned, or we spoke a little bit about manuscripts and the fact that Páraic O'Keefe, which is something you show to us in the documentary, he wrote all of this down. That's hugely unusual, I would have thought, and even more unusual to have Boeing instructions in on the music, the manuscript as well.
Yeah, I mean, for example, when I teach, I'm teaching music today at a festival, towards the end of a lesson, I'd say to the kids, "Oh, take your phone out and make a recording," and that's how people then bring the music home and practice it. But you know, this is kind of before the recording era, and there were other ways, and this was a really good way of doing it, writing it down. But also, you could bring the lesson home with you as well, in a way, because you could bring all that technique home with you if you had these manuscripts. In fact, he could even teach the lesson when the kid wasn't there, because he could go and call into a house, write the manuscript, collect the money and go out
and head
then
off.
You know, there's anecdotes of that happening as well.
Yeah, and the sort of markings that he used to indicate whether it was an up bow or a down bow, and the kind of, you know, those kind of lovely little grace notes that he puts in, and that you gave us in those three tunes, was it something equivalent to the way a classical score might be marked in terms of an up bow and a down bow, or was it his own little method?
It's certainly his own method, but it does have echoes of sort of systems you would see elsewhere, I think. But no, like in classical music, you have a horseshoe for a down bow and a V for an up bow. But he uses a sort of a tick, which looks a bit like a V, so I think to indicate the bow and direction. And that's how he did that. But then he wouldn't have used, it's not, the notes are in this classical stave. He treated the, if you have in mind a music stave, the gaps between the lines as strings on the fiddle. So you have G, D, A, E, and if you write 0, 1, 3 on the, where you would have an F on a stave, then that would mean D.
Right, so he had his own mode of notation, which obviously all of his pupils would have understood and been able then, as you said, to have the lesson as a result, as well as travelling around. And you speak to several different people along the way. Matt Cranich opens up that whole Boeing idea to us. You talk to Peter Brown about various recordings as well. But I was struck by Mary McCarthy, the publican, who you spoke to in Castle Island. This is in Tom McCarthy's pub. She opened up a little bit to you, I think, the nature of the man himself. It would seem that despite that, I would guess he was quite a hard taskmaster when it came to the teaching, but he was a very quiet man.
Yeah, I mean, and now I have to admit, you've seen the programme and I haven't yet seen it, so this is going back in my memory a bit, but it was fantastic to speak to people who actually knew him and to get to kind of get an idea of the man, because what we know of his life, he had perhaps a rough time at home when he was young, and then he left and spent a lot of time with his maternal uncles and aunts, who were very musical, down a place called Doon. And we get an idea, especially from the folklore, of the man, of a very quick wit. And there's lots of stories of that kind. And I mean, yeah, the man has become
a legend
in local folklore, especially in that part of Kerry.
And how responsible would you say is he really and truly for the style of fiddle playing that exists in that part of the world?
Well, it's certainly, he had a massive influence on, let's say, the generation of fiddle players born between 1910 and say 1950, even in that area, like a huge influence. And you know, styles change and things do change. But still today, he's revered and people go back. I'm certainly not the first person to go back at these manuscripts and try and learn from O'Keefe years and years later. So
One final question to you. I know that you were learning music as a child, and I think you got a little bit fed up with it. It was when your mother sent you off to her own native Scotland that you got an interest in Scottish music. Is she disappointed that you didn't stick with the Scottish side of it and you went off over to that other island and went way down to the very south of it to explore your musical tastes?
I don't think so. In a way, I maybe she didn't even think that that would stick. That was like a last-ditch effort, maybe. I don't know. So I think they were just glad that I kept on playing, and they didn't mind where I went. And in fact, they were very supportive of me when I started coming to Ireland in my teens. You know, they'd put money in my pocket and send me off to a festival, and, you know, I'd... This was before kind of WhatsApp, and, you know, I'd find an internet cafe and tell him I was still alive in some pub in West Clare, you know.
There you go. Yeah. Listen, we'll tune Ella Agat solar I mean too.
Tá, yeah, shine my couple port in the Kyle v Kyle Yibrig Kyle the lady who did it a glory.
Yeah, Kyle McCauley and Agus on Bazooki on Turlish and Irish Kyle the toy Kyle.
She, yeah, Agus shine him raw for the food is all live screeny. Father Gahif Daly's Netherkin Daly Agus and Tarnakianas and Sullivan's Lagan the Sullivan's March.
Sullivan's March, right. So two jigs then, Daly's and Sullivan's, Andrea Palandri on violin, and Kyle McCauley on bouzouki. Two jigs there, Daly's and Sullivan's, played for us in our Ballyanong Owl studio this evening by Andrea Palandri on violin and Kyle McCauley on bouzouki. Míle buíochas as Verling anocht, Andrea, agus Kyle.
Tá míle fortaíochas, gur míle maith agat.
And Tuska an Tubber, the series on TG Cahar that Andrea presents the first episode of, will be broadcast on Sunday nights between the 12th of May of this year, obviously, and that's on TG Cahar. And you'll find it on the website, tgcahar.ie. Friday evening and time for our album reviews. First up will be That Golden Time, sixth studio album from Villagers, and arena listeners will have already been introduced to some of the tracks on the album. Conor O'Brien and his band launched the album in a special live programme here in RTE Radio Studio 1 on Tuesday evening. That is still available to you, by the way, on the RTE Radio player if you want to listen back. Nashville Rockers, Kings of Leon, are back with another five-word album title, Can We Please Have Fun, starring Caleb and singer, I beg your pardon, Caleb Followill, has called it the most enjoyable record he has ever been part of. I love the way they say that about every record they've ever done. Not just him, every musician ever. They are due to play Marley Park in Dublin on July the 5th. Obviously, they'll be speaking to me nicely after that comment. And Australian brother and sister duo Angus and Julia Stone return with their sixth album, Kate Forrester. They play their first Irish show in over a decade later this month, and that's at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. Villagers, let us start with Villagers and Conor O'Brien. He spoke to me, did I say that John Maher and Louise Bruton were our reviewers on this Friday evening. He spoke to me, as I say, on Tuesday evening in that special programme, John, and I got a sense that in some ways this was Conor O'Brien, Villagers, returning to becoming a jackal. He was looking to get back to almost where he started out.
Yeah, well, I suppose a lot of these songs began their genesis during lockdown when he was on his own and he's kind of tinkering away in his kind of makeshift studio at home. And also on the album, much of it is played by himself. You do have some significant guest appearances and we can talk about that later. There is a little bit of getting back to basics, certainly after Fever Dreams, the album from 2021, which was quite maximalist and expansive. This does feel more low-key, I suppose more rooted in the songcraft itself. There's some beautiful arrangements as well, but it does feel like a more intimate collection.
Yeah, and that was the sense I got on Tuesday evening. Like I felt like if Conor O'Brien and Villagers were playing in my sitting room, it had that intimate feel to it. And a song like First Responder, which is one of the songs he didn't perform for us on Tuesday night's programme, Louise, a song like First Responder has a direct connection to COVID, obviously, but also it kind of then goes into a more oblique places.
Yeah, well, I think it's something that Conor has always done with his music is that there's always this very romantic soundscape that he has, but he's a great way of hiding everyday horrors in the music that you can, in the lyrics that you could almost overlook because there's such a sweet melody to it. And his voice is always, it's a lulling voice that he has. And he himself is such a charming presence that you can almost overlook whatever the darkness is that he's saying. And I do find that even though this album sounds warm and it sounds light and he has just compositions in his back pocket for days, a lot of the themes kind of fall into this idea of isolation, self-loathing, distrust of society. And yeah, it kind of falls into First Responder as well, where he's kind of critical of the way that we react to things happening in the world and if we're all just self-driven. And yeah, selfishness, I think, is a really core thing that he's examining on this album.
All right, let's have a listen to First Responder.
A first responder is serving a small.
That's First Responder from Villagers and the new album, That Golden Time. John, I was saying as we were listening to that, I was talking about the poetic nature of Conor O'Brien's lyrics and very, very evident in that song as it is in others as well. But he is quite angry, if that's... And I said this to him, and he was quite angry. You could see it in him. But he was quite polite in his anger. But when you start delving down into those lyrics, and particularly the songs that deal with the post-internet age.
Yeah, and particularly...
He's really cheesed off with all of that.
He is, and particularly the era we're in now where social media toxicity is such a topic of discussion. By his own admission, during the pandemic, you know, he said, you know, you'd have a glass of wine and you'd fire off a tweet and you'd kind of regret it afterwards. And you'd be embroiled in these war of words with strangers in most cases. And as he said, it saps energy and it takes you away from the stuff that's worthwhile. The album titled That Golden Time seems to refer to a period before the internet, but also that period where we carve time to just put our phones away and look at the beauty that's around us. And the album cover features a beautiful rendering of a moth and there's a little like Kavanagh, Patrick Kavanagh. He's looking at the beauty in the banal here as well. There's a striking line in the title track about algorithm blues, because this sense that we've been sucked into this world where the Elon Musks of the universe are kind of playing us and making us angry.
Yeah, and dividing people that you know.
Absolutely.
You're either on the extreme left or the extreme right. They kind of been in between the middle somewhere, and any grey area is kind of not allowed. And that's part of what he's singing about here, which I think in some ways, because he's looking for this nuanced set of opinions, Louise, and a kind of where things aren't clear cut, it makes the lyrics sometimes you have to sift through them quite a lot to get to what he's actually saying.
Yeah, at times I do feel like he's almost dancing around the point, not committing to what it is that he believes, but he's unhappy with what everybody else believes.
Well, isn't that part of what he's at though, is like to say there is no, you can't kind of pin it down and say this is exactly how it is, and if you think otherwise you're a fool.
Yeah, but he's quite angry about that, whatever that is. But even the whole culture that goes into it as well, I think You Lucky One is a very interesting take on the idea of being online and being creative. And it's quite a sarky song in a way, because he says to whoever it is, he could be singing to himself, you've been off the grid, cutting your teeth, supposedly composing your masterpiece. I'll give you a good copy, then I'll cut you some slack. And it's just, it's so...
It's acerbic. It is acerbic. Yeah,
there's a lot going on there.
There is a lot going on. Now, as I said, the full programme from Tuesday night is available on the RT Radio Player. He gave us three tracks from the album, and he also gave us some old material as well. And we've a special bonus track that we're going to put out some other night. We'll tell you about that when the time is right. However, stars from you, Louise, for Villagers and That Golden Time.
Yeah, like I said, he's got compositions that will always be there ready and be gorgeous, but I'd love some new themes from him. So that's why 3.5 stars for me. I feel we kind of gained nothing new from the inside.
All right, John?
Well, I just want to add that within the beauty of the songs, you've got contributions from Donal Lunny and Peter Broderick, both of whom really do a fine job here.
Well, I think he credits Lunny with opening up one of the songs totally for him in the bouzouki playing. I think it might have been You Lucky One, but I'd have to check that in my head.
Absolutely. And I think it's quite an understated album. It's a real grower, one to get under the skin, and it's a very solid 4 stars.
All right, 4 and 3.5 respectively for Villagers in That Golden Time. Let's move on to Kings of Leon. Can We Have Fun, Please? 1999, Tennessee brothers Caleb, Jared and Nathan Followill and their cousin Matthew formed Kings of Leon. Became one of the biggest bands in the world now, 25 later. They have just released their 9th studio album called Can We Please Have Fun. Here is a track. What track am I going to start with? Let's have Mustang. There we have Mustang from Kings of Leon and Can We Have Fun, Please? I was saying, when I was listening to that earlier today, I heard Bruce Springsteen vocals towards the end of it, but you had a different sound in your mind, I think, Louise, as you were listening.
Yeah, I just kept thinking about LCD Sound System, who would have been their peers back when they started out in around 99, 2000. That sort of ranting about being older and being surrounded by younger people and trying to figure out where your place is. And that's, I think, what Kings of Leon have been doing for maybe the last 7 or 8 years of their career. How do they exist within a scene that they're not particularly fond of? And I think that this album is the compromise where they go back to their kind of their indie-ish beginnings, where they were long-haired Pentecostal escapees who kind of sounded like they swam out of the swamp, and then
the guitar still has the swampy sound there,
still
Mustang
swamping along.
Yeah,
and then they cut off all their hair, and they were suddenly heartthrobs and releasing songs like "Sex on Fire," which I think it brought them great success, but probably not much personal joy.
But lots of money, though.
Lots of money, rolling around in money.
This album, John, is produced by Kid Harpoon, the Harry Styles award-winning house. He was the producer of that as well.
Yes.
Is that influence on the album to your ears?
Absolutely, because I think that this album sounds very bright and clean and kind of... Actually, the song we heard, Mustang, is possibly the most quintessential Kings of Leon song here. There are synthesizers here. There's a sense of a band trying to rebirth almost. I mean, it's 20 years since that huge second album, Aha Shake Heartbreak, came out, and they were so young at the time. You know, they were barely into their 20s, almost like child actors struggling to make that transition to adulthood. And certainly, like Louise mentioned, Sex and Fire, and that was huge then. But after that, they kind of had this period where nobody really cared. I mean, there have been swathes of Kings of Leon albums that have passed me by, and the great record buying and listening public as well. And this feels like even the title of the album, Can We Please Have Fun, you know, where it had become a bit of quite a bit of drudgery for them up to now, and a sense of trying to maybe expand their palette a little. And I think they have, to a degree.
Yeah.
It feels like a popular kind of album, a sort of fresher album than what they were doing before. And yet, in a way, it feels like there are problems there here too.
Every time I was getting ready to interrupt you, I was to say there's a lot of qualifying going on in your statement.
There is,
John.
You made
a further qualifying statement.
There's an enormous but at the end of all this.
Yeah, there were several buts in the middle of it as well. Are you in the same boat, in that kind of slightly I wish it was better feed, which is what I'm getting off, John?
I was surprised it was as good as it was, because I had seen them, I was reviewing them when they were playing maybe the last time in Ireland for whichever forgettable album that was. And it was difficult to watch, because they were performing as some other people that they had no connection to. But I do feel that Wildest does sound new thanks to the production.
Yeah.
But I also think that it is throwing back to older sounds. I feel like Ballerina Rodeo, which is the song that opens the album, there's a Pulp-like quality to that song, where there's sort of a kind of a twirling and dancing element to it that I love.
Okay, so I'm actually getting that you're happier with this new album as opposed to all the other forgettable albums, that I think was the phrase that you used, dismissing their entire back catalogue. What are they getting stars-wise for Kings of Leon for Can We Please Have Fun?
It was 4 for me, for my low expectations that were raised.
Way surpassed, okay.
Well, I also had low expectations, and they sort of satisfied me, and then I kind of felt, but it isn't like one of the early great albums. It's 3 stars for me.
I thought you were going to say, it's 3 stars, but... No, 3 stars, okay. Let us move on then. Now, we've had 3 brothers and a cousin. Now let's have a brother and a sister. Are you getting married soon? Here's a song for you. Starlight. Do you know how lovely you are in the moonlight of my eyes? Oh, that's a brother and sister duo there. Are you a fan of the family dynamic or genre, Louise?
I mean, some people do like to keep it in the family, and maybe this is the stone, the family stone affair. But they have been going for a very long time.
And 20 years there.
20
right,
years. Yeah. And this album is named, they're from Australia, and Cape Forestier is a Tasmanian peninsula, but it's also the name of a boat that they had when they were growing up. And Brother Angus describes the journey of that boat and reflects everything that they've gone through in their careers, where he says, "One of our trips was so wild with these storms raging, and it just chugs through so steady. It feels a little bit like the journey we've been on, so we wanted to acknowledge that." I do not see anything in that statement, in anything in this album, but chugging is definitely what they're doing with this one.
But hold on now a little minute with all of your cynicism. Any couple listening to that song, because it is the wedding song, I think they wrote it for friends of theirs who were getting married. You can see the wedding video. You can see the tears all through whoever's at the wedding. Mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts. Everybody's going to be upset, and including the couple who will be getting married. Everybody's going to be in tears. And why not?
Well, it's evocative for sure. And loads of, loads of these songs are.
Oh boy, is there a butt coming here?
There might be. There might be. There's certainly a maybe. Yeah. I mean, she reminds me to a degree of Stevie Nicks. I mean, there's also
it's not a bad thing to be reminded of.
And I have to say, in isolation, some of these songs are really excellent,
lovely harmonies,
yeah, beautifully done. There's a simplicity to it, there's a beautiful approach. Sometimes their voices mesh together in a really nice way. My problem is that it's just the tempo and the sameness. It over the course of an album, it just doesn't do a huge amount. But taken in isolation, I think some of the songs are really beautiful.
Oh, because you're going to say, I thought you were going to say really nice, because you said nice once and then really beautiful. I thought nice was a word I was going to hear a lot of, Louise.
Well, there's a few surprising things about this album, in that this is the first one that they've recorded together since 2017. And in saying that, the wedding song is a song they wrote 15 years ago. And then there's another song on the album called No Boat, No Airplane, which Angus wrote when he was 15 years old. And then they've got two covers on the album as well.
All right. Okay. stars very quickly.
Oh, too bluntly.
And too bluntly.
No, I'm going to be kinder. Three, I think. Three. It's worth investigation.
All right. And just before we go, John, 10 seconds on Steve Albini, who died during the week.
What
important.
Extraordinarily legendary figure, a producer of huge renown, so many artists, Nirvana, Pixies. I interviewed the authors, Lou Keynes, a few weeks ago, and he talked about him because he'd worked with him, and he'd written a book about freaks. This is Haynes, and he said that maybe Albini was a freak in the very best sense of the word.
And a very positive way to describe the man.
Yeah.
All right. So Kings of Leon, Angus and Julia Stone, Cape Forestier, Kings of Leon, Can We Please Have Fun, Villagers, That Golden Time, the albums that Louise Bruton and Joan Marr were speaking to us about this evening. That is our lot for tonight and for this week. Leah Murphy and Niall Fitzmaurice researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast cast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.